The Ulster Economic Podcast. The podcast that keeps you up to date with what is happening economy-wise in Northern Ireland. Telling you what you need to know, but not necessarily what you want to hear. It is better to be prepared for the economic environment we're operating in and not the world we'd like to be in. Episode 21. In Liz, We Trust. With Andrew Webb, Chief Economist at Grant Thornton. The end of one Elizabethan era has coincided with the start of another, with Liz Truss replacing Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. Kwasi Kwarteng became the third Chancellor of the Exchequer in just 3 months, and similarly, Northern Ireland saw the appointment of Chris Heaton-Harris, its third Secretary of State in 3 months, and the first Secretary of State with a double-barrelled name. These personnel changes will bring with them a new approach for a new era. Indeed, a new approach for a new era was a key message within Kwasi Kwarteng's mini-budget on the 23rd of September, a date that will go down in the history books of both the UK government and the Conservative Party. For Kwarteng, his new era and approach is focused on growth. To help deliver on this, the new Chancellor chose to sack the old hand at Treasury, Sir Tom Scholar, its permanent secretary since 2016, and a veteran of previous Chancellors and Prime Ministers. This move was clearly part of Liz Truss's desire to make a clean break from her predecessors and the prevailing economic orthodoxy. Part of this new approach has included junking the old approach of the Chancellor before last, Rishi Sunak. During the election campaign for the Tory leadership, households and businesses eagerly awaited the new regime's first fiscal event to address the issue of energy costs. Last week's fiscal event duly delivered, with an energy price guarantee amounting to £60 billion over the next 6 months alone. And in Northern Ireland, we await to see how that package will be applied and rolled out here. But while the unveiling of an energy price support package was meant to be the highlight of the Chancellor's first fiscal event, it was overshadowed by other elements of the so-called mini-budget. This was a kitchen sink budget, according to the BBC's Faisal Islam, with the Chancellor throwing almost everything into it, including a wide range of tax cuts and incentives. A mini-budget, it wasn't. But there was little to explain how it would all be funded. The Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, perhaps explained it best when she said that never before has government borrowed so much and explained so little. On the taxation side, there was a whopping £45 billion of tax cuts. That marked the biggest round of tax cuts since Anthony Barber's Dash for Growth in 1972. It has led some to say that this represents a dash for votes, with a general election due in 2024. And we shouldn't forget that all of these tax cuts were on top of the massive support committed to help businesses and households with energy costs, the overall cost of which will be at the mercy of gas prices. Unless you have been on another planet, you will know that the reaction of the mini-budget has not been good. I cannot recall a fiscal event that has been more universally panned and slammed by economists, think tanks, commentators at home and abroad. This included a slapdown by the IMF, who urged the UK to re-evaluate its plan. More importantly, the financial market reaction has been savage. The pound slumped to a record low against the dollar. The cost of government borrowing has soared. The Bank of England engaged in an emergency £65 billion intervention to avert a pensions crisis. And over 1,600 mortgage deals have been pulled. Mortgage rates have soared, triggering a cost of mortgage crisis, and the Bank of England has warned of a significant response, with markets pricing in bank rate interest rate rising by 150 basis points by the 3rd of November and hitting 6%, it's currently 2.25%, by next year. To sum up in the words of Ron Burgundy, that escalated quickly. It's hard to escape the fact that this was something of a Hail Mary budget, to coin a phrase from American football. Kwarteng was the quarterback throwing a desperation pass in the slim hope that the economy scores a touchdown by 2024. Not only does this look highly unlikely, but arguably he still had the ball in his hands when he was blitzed by the financial markets. Will Coach Truss now change the playbook for the next throw? For now, it looks like the lady is not for turning. So I'm delighted to be joined by Andrew Webb, Chief Economist at Grant Thornton, to unpack some of what has been happening over the last 6 or 7 days. So good afternoon, Andrew.
Afternoon.
And I suppose, turning to the most important question first, have you turned the central heating on yet?
Do you know, I was going to say I'm really pleased to be here, but more so because I'm pleased to be somewhere where someone else is paying for the heat. No, I haven't turned the central heating on at home yet. It's too scary to do that. But the context of that is what we'll get into today and how we pick our way through what comes next.
Yeah, indeed. And I cracked in the central heating front yesterday. But anyway, and I suppose in terms of what has surprised you the most of what has happened over the last 6 days since the mini-budget?
I suppose the pace at which it turned so dramatically against the government. Now, I suppose in the run-up to Liz Truss becoming leader, you know, Rishi was cautioning that this might happen and that inflation, you know, needs to be controlled. But, you know, the fears with her plans were that the markets would react and interest rates would have to rise. He's potentially sitting somewhere thinking, I told you so right now. But the pace at which that all flipped on the back of Friday's budget, non-budget fiscal event took me by surprise. I gave a presentation on Tuesday to an event. The slides had to be ready by Thursday evening, and I sent them in and said, this may change. And on Tuesday morning, I was, before speaking, was still inserting slides on where currency levels were and the projections for interest rates. So, you know, a slide that showed a couple of weeks ago interest rates might peak at 2 or 3, now saying 6, that shocked. And when I told that to the audience, you know, it's not often an economist gets an audible gasp when they tell a story, but there was certainly fear and surprise in that room on Tuesday morning. So that's taken me by surprise. And I suppose I've had a week where I see a great contrast, because I'm just back from Dublin, where the Irish budget was on Tuesday evening, and I was down in Dublin doing the various webinars and updates on that. And I mean, I wouldn't say it was a boring budget in Ireland, because they injected 11 billion and, you know, hopefully addressed a lot of the cost of living, but it passed off without incident, and you know, it was costed and thought through, and obviously there were adults that were in charge of it. It doesn't feel like we've had that in the UK in the last week.
Yep. And I suppose in at times of crisis, what I always find amusing, or sometimes when it's difficult to encapsulate what's going on, it's actually looking at the cartoonists who sort of sum things up, or even the red top front page headlines. And I think it was one of my favourite ones was the Daily Star's "Honey, I Shrank the Quids." And there's even up on social media, there are people talking about kamikaze economics. But turning to, you said about in terms of the market reaction, I suppose it's what is it the markets didn't like in the mini budget? And, you know, there was big tax cuts, 45 billion. What's wrong with that?
What is wrong with tax cuts? I suppose we'll have to unpack this. So we're going to hopefully take our time and step through. I mean, the logic I was okay with up to a certain point. The logic was, insofar as we could follow any, there was poor growth for the last decade or so, and a feeling that something had to be done differently to try and spark the UK economy into action. And, you know, the 2.5% per annum growth target has become the focus. So the logic of, okay, we've tried this system for ages and we're not getting too far, so what needs to change? But at that point, the logic snaps with what they've done. And the bit that I think really spooked the markets was that it was completely uncosted and not planned through. There's a really good structure in the UK when they use the OBR, which was implemented just to try and maintain a sense of certainty and clarity about where the public finances are and how affordable things are. All of that was cast away.
It was George Osborne who said at the time when he set it up, it was to hold the feet of to hold the Chancellor's feet to the fire of for costings and all of that that you're highlighting.
Yeah, and the certainty of that, you know, that's not to say you couldn't move and borrow more and flex, and but to have a plan and to have that laid out and to have that assessed independently meant an awful lot to the markets. The UK's credibility and the amount they've had to borrow in the last number of years for the pandemic and all that goes with that, and then the vast amounts that we're now back into for energy caps, plus the fact that it was tax cuts that, you know, bring us back to 2019 levels that were framed around unleashing growth, but actually weren't. They were just tax cuts for rich people.
Yeah, because the abolition of the 45% tax rate, so it's gone away, benefited the mega rich.
It did, absolutely benefited the mega rich, and I was, you know, maybe not fair to highlight individuals, but Cristiano Ronaldo and Mo Salah are set to benefit to the tune of nearly 1.5 million per annum off the back of this. I don't see them trickling that spend down through, you know, a few extra nights out or a few more trips to Tesco. I don't see how that trickles down anywhere. So, you know, it feels like it was very targeted at a particular cohort. I think, you know, a dash for votes probably sums it up.
Yeah, it reminds me of that joke about I've got a joke about trickle-down economics, but 99% of you won't get it. But I suppose it's then coming back to what you're saying about the tax cuts, it's then they're unfunded. So we've had, you know, on the one hand, you had the 60 billion of energy price guarantee. That's over 6 months. For households, it's going to be guaranteed for 2 years. So, you know, you're going to be looking at maybe about 170 billion, that sort of range. And then it's when you add in the tax cuts, what was happening is you're going to see about 200 to 250 billion of borrowing, and the private sector has never been asked to digest that amount of money, you know, government borrowing. It's about double of what they would have been sort of used to. So it's all of that, and it's a fact that the growth or the tax cuts, if the aim is economic growth, yes, you would argue corporation tax, reducing it or not increasing it from 25% and keeping it 19% is probably a safe enough option. The reversing Rishi Sunak's increases in national insurance contributions was probably, I personally thought it was unwise to implement it at the start, but it's just that markets have got totally spooked because they just do not like what they see, and the fact that institutions have been taken out of this, and in many ways we have to wait until the 23rd of November until the costings will be revealed.
I'm not sure we'll get to November without a U-turn or without some serious, you know, alternate position, either from Bank of England, who have already had to step in. I mean, just think about that. The UK Central Bank having to intervene to protect the UK economy from the UK government. I can't think of another time that's had to happen. And what that does then in terms of the UK's credibility. So, you know, you're almost now baking in that the UK is not a credible place to do business. And if the exactly that. And if you were trying to create an environment where it's great to be an investor, and that, you know, there'd be all this new inward investment and unleash growth, but you're making it a place where it doesn't look like a certain environment in which to do business, it's so counterintuitive. And just on the energy piece, part of the challenge and what spooked the markets is that not only is it unfunded, but they don't know what the cost will be because they've capped the price, so they're at the mercy then of what the wholesale prices do, whereas in other jurisdictions, like, you know, Ireland, have just offered money into people's coffers. That's different. That can be costed. Now, they might have to come back and revisit stuff like that, but the UK went all in with, this is the price, we're fixing it for the next while, and what the market does, we'll just have to absorb.
Okay. And the big focus, they said, was on the supply side in this economic growth plan. And can you explain, sort of, what do they mean by supply side? And, you know, what's not to like about some of the supply side measures that they have announced?
Well, if we could take them at their word and that they were going to unleash supply side initiatives, you think about what drives economic performance. So it would be skills. infrastructure, things like that, things that make it easier for an economy to function and increase the capacity of an economy to deliver. But this is a government who, over a number of years, have cut spending in real terms on education and skills, have made it harder to do business with our European neighbours, who haven't invested anything like enough in infrastructure. So I don't know where this supply side miracle is going to come from, but that seems to be what they're trying to pin this on. And you know, there have been announcements in the growth paper about fracking and making planning easier. I think a government that's running out of ideas always goes to, we're going to cut red tape, we're going to have a bonfire of regulations. That always strikes me as, that sounds good, but never actually means much, I don't think.
And we've been told, because there was a subsequent statement after there was the kind of kerfuffle in the markets over the last number of days, where the Treasury then came out to then clarify that they would be providing more explanation as to what these supply side reforms are going to be to help get this medium term growth target of 2.5%, such as looking at immigration, looking at childcare initiatives, looking at planning reform. And there's obviously going to be things like trying to relax building restrictions on Greenbelt and things like that, which are going to be very unpopular. But yes, as you say, it's all kind of very vague and lacking in detail, and a series of cabinet ministers have been lined up in the coming weeks to try and soothe market concerns about, by trying to put more flesh on the bones in that regard. But I suppose the thing is, from a Northern Ireland perspective, issues like planning, supply side reforms, we're at the mercy of the executive. All the things in terms of like planning reform, when we've got infrastructure deficits, which mean you cannot build housing because there isn't the water and sewage. So there's all of these kind of things, and it's just a lot of these changes. I would fear it's easier said than done.
It is. And I mean, I suppose what we've been through in the last number of years with the pandemic, Brexit, so much of our attention taken to that, I sometimes have to go and proactively remind myself of all the old economic challenges that we face. We're not as entrepreneurial as we could or should be. We don't have that infrastructure. I mean, it's in the billions of pounds, the work that needs to happen to Northern Ireland's infrastructure. And it's money we don't have, money we don't have a plan for. And therefore, we just start to really restrict our ability to do anything. Trade's not easy. There's a lack of clarity around the protocol. And so those many challenges need to be addressed. But then we get thrown into this absolutely chaotic, unnecessary scenario where you, as part of the UK, and in a context where the government has launched this unfunded splurge, lack of credibility, becomes more difficult for businesses to operate here.
I think the big thing, the big sort of surprise was, you had on the Thursday, the day before the mini budget, you had the Bank of England increasing rates by 50 basis points, with some of them wanting to go higher. So on the one hand, you had the Bank of England is trying to apply the brakes on inflation and slow things down to get inflation down, whereas then 24 hours later, or not even 24 hours later, you then have the Chancellor then throwing a fiscal stimulus, which is only going to throw more petrol in the inflation fire. And I think that's what caught investors, the kind of financial markets, is, you've got, if one institution is applying this accelerator and the other is trying to apply the brakes, we know if you're doing that in a car, you'll be pulling a donut or going in a tailspin. And it's been sterling assets have gone in a tailspin, and as has sterling. So it's like that kind of inconsistency and incoherence of, we're doing something which is inflationary, while the Bank of England is trying to dampen down on that. And it just, and the net result has been, as I said, about the surge in mortgage rates. So we'd all knew that interest rates were going to go higher, but now you've got the markets, instead of the markets looking for maybe interest rates going to about 4.5%, and yesterday it was 6.25%. And markets are probably exaggerating, because I think the pain of interest rates when it gets up into the 4s and 4.5% is going to be so severe, you're going to have inflation coming down.
That was striking, that disconnect between what you would expect to be a very connected set of institutions. You know, you would expect that Treasury, OBR, Bank of England would be on common purpose. I think what we have is a new leadership and chancellor who have grown up, my understanding is they've grown up surrounded by think tanks, and this feels like a bit of an experiment in this is the way to do it. We're right, you know, out with the old guard, out with the old ways. Let's try this. I keep thinking of it almost humorous, but it's humorous in a shock and awe type of way about how potentially damaging it could be. So it's more despair when I laugh about this stuff. But I remember, I think it was, when there used to be a budget, you could go online and sort of pretend to be the chancellor and sort of tweak things and see what the impact had been on, you know, families or individuals and business. And you would play around with that and, you know, I'd be a great chancellor. And then you would just play around with it and try to break it. And I feel like we're in that sort of space at the minute where they've just tried stuff that people told them wouldn't work. I imagine that the most senior official in the Treasury was coming to tell them that this wouldn't work, so they got rid of him. They've sidelined the OBR, and they've just implemented what they are ideologically aligned to without that sense of, did they consider what the markets would react like? Did they consider that, you know, they cut stamp duty to try and support the housing market, but they're... the implications of what they've done are that interest rates could potentially hit 6%. Did they think any of this through? I don't know if they did, or if they did, do they care?
And then I suppose in terms of, so we're now all waiting for this OBR forecast, or whether it's going to be an OMG sort of forecast and assessment, and that's on the 23rd of November. If the markets behave themselves, you know, we'll sort of wait to that. But is it going to be possible to then get an OBR assessment and forecast, which is going to rubber stamp their plans in that what has happened since Friday, a lot of the things are a lot worse. The interest rates, all of those kind of things are more negative. So it's what the OBR would have, the opinion that they would have given on what was presented to them on Friday, and what they're going to do now is going to be vastly different.
But I would say Friday was phase one of what I would regard to be two phases. Phase one being what they did, phase two being slashing public spending. And that's probably what they're trying to work through at the minute and give the message to their ministers that find as many efficiency savings as you can, which is usually, yeah, I mean, it's going to be potentially massive cuts coming if that's how they try to get some form of credibility back.
Yeah, that's going to balance it up. And I suppose one of the concerns would be that it's normally we're approaching getting the next inflation figures, CPI figures, and the CPI figures for September, which will be in a couple of weeks' time, they're used to then set welfare benefits for from next April for the next financial year. So last year it was set at, or last September it was 3.1%. So in April, welfare benefits increased by just 3.1%, which was way below inflation. And there was, you know, calls for whether they needed to increase that. Now it looks like inflation is going to be about 10%. Good news for people on welfare benefits. But that was a Rishi Sunak promise to keep that link. And there appears to be some doubt over whether that will happen. And in light of what you're saying about the need to slash public spending, it could look like a bit of a overly optimistic to think that people on welfare benefits are going to see that 10% and whether it'll be significantly less.
I've noticed they haven't committed to that yet. It's interesting that they think that if by cutting taxes for people who are very well off, that incentivizes them to do more activity, and they don't see that same link further down. They don't see that if you give people at the lower ends of the income streams and on benefits more of an incentive to, you know, do more work, they'll do that. I'm increasingly struggling with what they're at, and it just feels like they are incentivizing their rich, potential donors or voters, and it's very ideological, without much of a care for that, what they would call the trickle-down part. They don't seem, they've gone out on a limb there that there will be trickle-down. I can't see where it comes from. It doesn't work. And they don't seem to be doing much to then directly intervene on people who need help.
Yeah, it's been economic confidence in the management of the UK economy has been trickling down. And I suppose a big issue is this hike in mortgage rates. And, you know, there's talk of, in the UK, falls of 15 to 20% in terms of prices. And what do you make of it here in kind of Northern Ireland and the outlook? And I suppose it is, we had mortgage rates where over the last year or so, people were maybe able to pick up a mortgage rate with, which started with a 1%. Sort of percent, whereas it's now going to be, you know, a 5 or a 6.
I mean, we've had a decade or so of people who have made financial decisions based on an environment that was stable in terms of the interest rate regime, and you know, it was low, but there was a sense that it was going to stay low and creep back up. I mean, I think when people were doing sensitivity analysis or you know, stress testing their own affordability, you know, they might have been taking a payment from sort of 2%, 2.5% to maybe 3.5 or 4, which wasn't a bad idea. But you know, if we're letting into 5s and 6s, that's going to push an awful lot of people into an affordability crisis. And you know, when we match that against an energy cost issue, there's not enough disposable income to absorb all of that. So we could be into a really rocky ride in terms of people's ability to repay their mortgages, and therefore, you know, a downturn on housing. That all sounds a bit fearmonger like, but we are in febrile times where it's we are talking about 6% interest.
Yeah, it's also in terms of if you were actually going and trying to select those indicators which would, or those factors which would bring about a fall in house prices, you've kind of got the full suite of those there. The one sort of thing supporting prices is, has been the lack of supply, and probably what we're going to see is that's going to worsen, because you're going to see then it doesn't make sense even for some builders, given the affordability, and so there'll be even less building. And then in terms of, there's probably going to be forced sales, which is always the thing which is the big negative for the economy. And then if people are going into the rental market, we all know about the rental market in Northern Ireland, is there's a shortage of properties there. So it's going to be extremely, extremely difficult on that front. I suppose in terms of, Andrew, then just thinking about, look, what happens next? We've had this kind of financial market kind of crash. We've got this kind of financial market negative reaction crash is probably fear-mongering, as you would say. But sort of what happens next? Because essentially you've got the UK government and financial markets are kind of playing a game of chicken, where I suppose the financial markets is bigger than the UK economy, and it's a bigger stick to hit the UK economy with. But so at the minute it's a game of chicken where the UK government isn't looking to sort of do a U-turn. So what do you think happens next? And if you were Chancellor, I suppose, first of all, if you were Chancellor, what would you do? And if you were the Bank of England Governor, what would you do?
I suppose as Chancellor, what would I do is I'd probably have to force myself to eat a fair bit of humble pie and reverse course. I think that's the only logical path to restore some form of credibility. And I think I've used credibility a few times. Credibility is shot. Can they get it back without a change of Chancellor or a change of Prime Minister? In fact, I've heard that could be the shortest Prime Ministerial sitting ever. But you know, if I was Chancellor, I think I would certainly U-turn on the 45p rate of tax. I would probably look again at the income tax, 19%, 20%. Really start to reverse out of some of those positions that were taken. I would allow the OBR full access to and lean on them for that piece of independent analysis. I think the Bank of England has stated its intention to, you know, support and prop up and intervene.
Although it said it wouldn't hesitate to act to raise interest rates, but it's hesitated to act by waiting until it says November the 3rd. And I suppose what surprised me is I thought at these times you would have an emergency meeting, go big and go early, you know, increase by at least 1%, maybe more. But that could still maybe happen in the coming weeks.
I thought they would have met by now. We're almost a week on from the Chancellor's announcements. I thought they would have met by now, but I think they have intervened in a slightly different way, and they've gone into the bond markets and they've tried to steady the ship in that way. And maybe it's a case of, will this storm pass? So maybe, it's hard to see how it does immediately. So maybe they have that interest rate hike in the coming days, but maybe they wanted to try other things first and just see how the markets react. So it's all to be watched with interest over the next while.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if there's a U-turn. So if there's going to be like a U-turn on the national insurance contribution increase and on the likes of the corporation tax, if there's a U-turn on that, then we'll have seen a 360-degree turn on what Rishi Sunak, and it'll be almost like continuity Rishi Sunak sort of policies. And it's, are we going to see a U-turn on chancellors and go back to a different chancellor? It is going to be a kind of challenging time.
It is. I mean, we've maybe spent too much time on social media this week just trying to get some sort of clarity and insight, and maybe that's not the best channel through which to try and achieve that. But you see all sorts of potential scenarios, like, you know, a general election, a change of chancellor, the bank hiking interest rates. We don't know. But we think, you know, the best path, I think, is to try and convince that there needs to be some sort of U-turn and reversal of some of those positions. How do they do that and save face? Well, maybe that's where they announce that they're going to achieve respectability and financial credibility, and maybe that's their phase two of the tax, or sorry, the spending cuts piece, that they say that we had a plan, and the next phase of all this is, you know, efficiencies and spending cuts.
Which is ominous when you think of the kind of industrial action and kind of autumn and winter of discontent that we're facing, that phase is going to get even worse. But no, thanks very much, Andrew. That's been great to chat with you.
Likewise.
I suppose we have to think we have our health, and just to remember that, you know, economies and economic growth can go up as well as down. So just looking at the incoming economic data and surveys for Northern Ireland during the month of September, and what's hot and what's not, we had the latest Northern Ireland output surveys for the second quarter, and they were a bit of a mixed bag. Private sector services, the largest sector, saw a 0.3% quarterly decline. That's down from its recent high. A more substantial fall of 2.4% quarter on quarter was evident within the retail sales index during the same period. That figure is expected to push further south as the cost of living crisis intensifies. Manufacturing, on the other hand, it notched up its fifth successive quarter of growth, albeit the 0.6% quarterly rise was half the rate of growth in the previous quarter. Food and beverage production, food and drinks, was a star performer with a stonking 6% plus quarterly gain in the second quarter, and up almost 14% over the year. And that is the largest annual increase outside of the pandemic since the series began. It's worth looking at the period from the first quarter of 2021 to Q2 2022. That period largely coincides with the introduction of the Northern Ireland Protocol, and Northern Ireland food, drink and tobacco output — we don't have any tobacco output, even though that sector classifies that — has increased by 18%. That's 2.5 times the increase in the equivalent sector in the UK. Northern Ireland Protocol, a coincidence? Northern Ireland's private sector growth, when we look at the PMI for September, contracted, with output sales and new orders falling for the fourth month running. Northern Ireland was one of 9 of the 12 UK regions reporting falling business activity. Retailers continue to bear the brunt of the downturn, and they posted the steepest drop in demand of the sector surveys. Inflationary pressures continue to be cited as a key factor curbing demand. However, August PMI saw the rate of input price inflation ease to its weakest rate since April last year. But it's worth noting that the price increases that are now being experienced are still stronger than anything that was reported before May last year. New car sales remain weak, impacted by the ongoing supply chain disruption, but August did see an 11% rise year on year. Sales for the first 8 months of the year are flat relative to the same period last year, but are still almost 30% below pre-pandemic levels. My electric car, ordered in July last year, is now built and it's being shipped, so it could be here for the next podcast. Northern Ireland's hoteliers continue to punch in strong sales figures. We saw room sales up 24% year on year in July, and that is still 6% below 2019 levels. But what we did see was a record number of beds sold, and July's hotel occupancy rate hit 75%. Encouraging figures, but the cost of living and cost of doing business challenges for the hotel and hospitality sector are mounting by the day. The labour market remains a source of positive news. Redundancies remain extremely low. Unemployment rate in the 3 months to July still sub 3%. And the number of employees on Northern Ireland's payrolls hit another record high in August. And they've been increasing for the last 12 months in a row. Looking to the month ahead in October, well, the last week or so has been fragile in financial markets as far as the UK economy is concerned. With no set piece game changers, either of the fiscal or monetary policy variety, slated for this month, unless we do see an emergency monetary policy committee meeting, the febrile financial market atmosphere is likely to persist. According to the Treasury statement earlier this week, UK cabinet ministers are set to announce further supply-side growth measures in October and early November on issues such as the planning system, business regulations, childcare and immigration. Some have dubbed this Operation Rolling Thunder. They will be desperately trying to shore up confidence in the government's new growth plan. To say they face an uphill challenge is perhaps an understatement. On the data front, we have UK CPI for September. We can expect a reading of around 10%, with the likes of food price inflation expected to rise to around 14% year on year. September's rate is normally significant, as it is the rate that non-pensioner-related welfare payments will be increased by in April next year. But with the prospect of spending cuts and the UK government needing to shore up on its credibility with the public finances, this could be one area where we could see the existing policy changed. The ASDA income tracker for Northern Ireland is due on the 25th of October. It could well show another record decline in year-on-year discretionary household spending in the third quarter of this year. And this will give us insight on the evolving cost of living crisis here in Northern Ireland. Following the mini-budget, the cost of mortgage crisis is a new angle that will hit households hard, with mortgage rates set to soar in October. This is unambiguously negative for both the UK and Northern Ireland housing markets. The cost of heating crisis will start to become real in October as well, as many of us finally succumb to putting the heating on. And businesses and households are still eagerly awaiting the details of how the energy cap will be applied here. September's PMI for Northern Ireland is expected to show the private sector remaining in contraction, with the equivalent survey for the Republic of Ireland likely to fall below the 50 expansion contraction threshold too. We also have the Northern Ireland Chamber of Commerce quarter three survey, which will include a tracker on the increased energy costs. In Northern Ireland, we have a penchant for crises. Number 10 and 11 Downing Street may be stealing the limelight as far as political crises are concerned, but another stormont deadline is looming. The current caretaker minister arrangement ends on the 28th of this month, and Chris Heaton-Harris, the Secretary of State, will then have to call an assembly election within 12 weeks. If an election does take place, it will be between the 29th of November to the 19th of January next year. Will we see the Secretary of State offer a trick or treat to persuade our MLAs back into Stormont? An autumn of discontent on so many levels beckons. Until next time, I am Richard Ramsay, and this was episode 21 of the Ulster Economics Podcast, In Liz We Trust, with Andrew Webb, Chief Economist at Grant Thornton. You can stay up to date by following us on social media and the UlsterEconomics.com blog.